by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to heaven in the middle of it. Rest make to heaven in the middle. We come. Rest make to heaven in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Hello, George.
Yeah, Charlotte, we've got just a wonderful guest this evening out of Chicago, University of DePaul, and he's just a wonderful guest. And his name is Dr. Jason Hill, and he's the author of a really fine book, We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People. Welcome to our program, Dr. Hill.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've read the book, and tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and where you came from originally and how you got to America, and what you know, motivated you to write this book.
Well, I was born and raised in Jamaica and came from a middle-class family, a class of politicians and intellectuals, and I came here at the age of 20 because I wanted to... I had fallen in love with America as a child and thought this was the greatest, most moral country on the face of the earth. I still think that way. Thought that the American people were the most exceptional people I had ever encountered in my visit to this country. And wanted to come here and make a contribution to America. So I came here as a legal immigrant at the age of 20 and moved to Atlanta, came with $120 in my pocket, and with no help from the government or the state, worked three jobs, put myself through school, graduated magna cum laude at the top of my class from Georgia State University, and then went on to earn a PhD to pursue philosophy at Purdue University. And I've been a professor now for 23 years, 18 of which have been spent at Georgia State. What motivated me to write this book was a sense of an increasing hatred of America that I think has been going on for a long, long time. But in the book, I describe that we live in an age of what I call Americophobia. And there are a number of writers from the extreme left, one of them being a writer, an African-American writer called Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote a book in which he called the American dream a racist construction of white people who had constructed this dream that exploited black people, that the dream was a fabrication of white people, that it was built on the expropriation of black labor, and that the America itself was an imperialist, racist, bigoted country that was intrinsically exploitative. And I took great offense at this. I said, this is a great country. It has had a racial past that was at times quite ugly. No one can deny that. It was born with a birth defect called slavery. We had segregation and Jim Crowism. But America is a very self-reflective, progressive country, and we have atoned for those wrongs against blacks in this country. So I wanted to write a love letter to the American people. I wanted to write a book to let Americans know that there's an immigrant who came here and did not see bigotry. I was motivated to write this book because we live in an age of Americophobia, And there are many writers in this country and people from the ultra left who were spewing invectives against this country and saying that the American dream was built on the backs of blacks, that it was exploitative, that it was a destroyer of neighborhoods, of literature, of everything great, and that America was a mean-spirited, imperialistic, and racist country. And then I thought that something was terribly wrong with this picture, that the American dream is alive, it is well, it is thriving, and I wanted to tell the story of why America's greatest treasure trove for people of what makes this country this magnificent country and made it possible for immigrants such as myself to be here.
I know you originally came in as a legal immigrant, is that correct? I think I made that point earlier.
Legal, yes, as a legal immigrant.
As a legal immigrant. Now, did your mother precede your coming before you came in with your grandmother? Is that right?
My mom came a month before I got here.
Okay.
I was 20. I was 20, and she thought we were just way, her boys were way too young. You know, her mamas are.
Okay.
So she wanted to be here. She wanted to be here for moral support. She couldn't contribute to my financial education. That was my responsibility as a grown man.
Right.
But she just wanted to be here to provide family support for her boys.
Oh, okay.
And so my brother came as well, and she took my grandmother, my 72-year-old grandmother, she dragged her along and said, we're all coming to give the boys moral support in their pursuits. And my brother immediately, on 2 weeks upon arrival in this country, he said, I'm going to serve America, and he joined the military, which was an amazing thing for him to do.
Didn't you think, what went through your mind when you walked off the plane? Wasn't there something that went through your mind about being in America? There was some kind of a thought that went through your mind. What was that?
I made a covenant with this country the minute.
Yeah, tell us about that covenant. Yeah.
The covenant I made with this country was that I would never, ever have a sense of entitlement towards this great republic. I would never ask the American people or this country to give me anything that I didn't work for myself, that I would offer the best within myself, the noblest, the most highest within myself, I would offer to my compatriots, my future fellow citizens. The covenant I made was that I would honor the sacred values of this republic and live by them, the best within the American spirit, the best that America had to offer. And I've never had to renege on the covenant. The covenant has what has kept me alive and going in some very dark moments that I've had in this country, not to do with the American people, just sometimes professional setbacks, personal setbacks. I remember that covenant that 20-year-old boy made the minute he landed, that he would have no sense of entitlement, that the government, the country owes you nothing except an opportunity to pursue your goals and not to place any obstructions in your path.
Didn't your grandmother make a comment too at that time, or was that earlier in the flight?
Well, as we were boarding the flight.
Oh, yeah, boarding the plane. Tell us about that.
Said, America, here we come. As we were boarding the flight in Jamaica, she was dressed up in her pearls and her silk dress and her high heels.
A silk dress, nice looking.
But she was a very glamorous woman. You know, I come from a very mixed background. Her father was a Sephardic Jew, and he had married a Jamaican woman.
Okay.
And so she was a very glamorous woman, and she said, "America." She threw her head back, and she laughed, and she said, "America, here we come."
All right.
And I thought that was the most exciting. If I can look back on my life, you know, I've written several books. I have 4 college degrees now, and I've made so many strides in my life. But the happiest day in my life was the day that I really landed in this great country of ours.
Well, you know what really stood out to me, Dr. Hill, is you're very appreciative. And you're aware of what this country has to offer for someone that's willing to go out and work. And you worked a couple of jobs, put yourself through college and so forth. So the opportunity is there, is it not?
In this great country of ours, I really think that every opportunity avail itself, I'm sure, every opportunity avail itself to people who are willing to take advantage of those opportunities. But I must say that you've got to have a certain attitude towards your country. You know, you cannot be resentful towards this great country. You cannot see this country as an evil, mean-spirited, oppressive country. You've got to have a spirit of generosity. America is a generous country. It's a benevolent country. And there are so many opportunities. And I tell my students all the time, whether you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, whether you're scrubbing a toilet with a scrub brush, no job is a dead end job. Every job in America is an opportunity to take you to the next level. There is dignity in hard work, no matter what you're doing. And I tell some of these stories in the book. I have met so many semi-illiterate immigrants who came from other countries legally. They came here legally. They could barely speak the language. They put themselves through school. I watched one who put himself through school and became a nurse. Learned the language on his own by watching a lot of TV. And went to school, learned to speak the English language. You know, even I still have my accent because I came here very late, but he wanted to have an American accent and went on to become to get a master's degree in nursing. You know, this country has endless opportunities for people if you're willing to look for them, if you're willing to take advantage of them, and above all, if you feel that the state doesn't owe you anything. You're not entitled to the outcome. You're not entitled to anything. You're just permitted to be free to pursue those amazing opportunities. And the opportunity itself is a blessing, because I've seen the other side. I've traveled all over the world now. You know, in my work, I give talks in Europe and Asia and South America. And I can see in other countries where there aren't even opportunities. People talk about we need to have equality of outcomes. And I say, in other countries, there aren't even opportunities. And in this great country, we have so many opportunities.
Right. You know, you sound like you've become an American, have you? Haven't you?
I'm an American.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So many of these people come here and they're this, that, and so forth, but you are really an American, aren't you?
I'm a true-blooded American.
Yeah,
I
fight
for this country. I would defend this country. But you know, the most important thing is that it's not to die for your country, it's to live for your country, to live each day the virtues, the values that make this country the great country that it is. But I feel like an American. I feel that this is my home, this is where I belong. Whenever I go abroad, the minute the plane touches down in America, I say, thank you, God, for bringing me back home to this great country that has brought me where I am today, and for which I am heavily indebted and owe a great deal of gratitude. Because immigration, you know, is not a human right. It is not there's nowhere in the Constitution that says you have a right to immigrate. Immigration is a privilege.
Yes, it is.
It's not a right. Yeah. It's a privilege that America grants to those whom it sees fit to let into its borders. And we have to respect that. Now we're living in a country where people think that America is up for grabs and that they have a human right to come here. And I think there's something wrong with that picture.
Wasn't that the president of Mexico that said that it was a human right to
Right.
Come illegally.
Yeah, the elected president said that, I think. Overdone,
right.
I think.
Say that. Yes, that's right. That's right.
But you know, Dr. Hill, you're beginning to be. You're not only considered to be a minority by being black, but are you a minority within a minority in the college and university system, though, in a way?
You know, I feel that way. I feel that. I was always, you know, I come from a long line of communists, I must tell you. My grandfather was a communist.
Right.
Who fought the English.
Okay.
And my father was a socialist. My grandmother was a socialist. I was never tempted by the left, by the far left, by the communists. But I did consider myself a sort of centrist liberal.
Right.
And as I began to see the corrosive effects that the far left was having on this great, on this country, the attacks being made, my political principles began to shift more towards conservatism. And I do feel that in my own university, in my own profession, I do feel that I'm a minority within a minority group. Because, you know, I am an old-fashioned professor who believes in something like objective truth, in rationality. I also believe that there's a role for religious intellectuals to play in the university. I believe in the Western canon. I do not believe that university professors should be politicizing the classroom and indoctrinating our students into cultural Marxism and left-wing ideology while leaving out the other side, the other perspective. See, I'm a true scholar. If you're going to have that, then you've got to give the other side a chance so that students have a fair and balanced perspective. If you're going to teach them communism and Marxism and left-wing ideology, then you've also got to show them that there's there are other perspectives. They live in these curated silos where they never hear other perspectives. And I do feel like I feel quite alone in the sense that the viewpoint that I represent is a minority one. The other thing, too, is that people expect me to be a victim. You know, they want a victim story because I'm a minority. They want me to tell them that America is a bad place.
Right.
That I've been beaten down, but I've been beaten down by all the racists in this country. And I must tell you, when I moved to Atlanta, we lived in Ku Klux Klan country. Our neighborhood was predominantly Klan because land was cheap, and Caribbeans wanted land that was cheap, you know. And so we lived with people who had their Confederate flags, and they were Klan members. And I don't know what they thought of me privately, but I must say that my neighbors were very, very polite to me. So I'm a runner. I would jog in my neighborhood, and I would see all these self-identified Klan members. And I would actually stop and say to them, "I'm Jason. I just moved from Jamaica." And I caught them off guard, you know, and I don't recall any experience with any of these people who, you know, what they might have thought of me privately, I don't know. But the important thing about America and about the South, one of the things I love about the South after having lived there for 8 years, is the show of civility, the show of a public face of respect. And they would all say, "Welcome to America," and they would say, "What you gonna do with your life, boy?" And I would say, you know, I would tell them both philosophy, and they would say, "Is that like psychology?" I would say, "Well, I'm also studying a little bit of psychology also." And but I didn't have a victim story to tell people on the very, very far left. I didn't have a story of being beaten down. You know, I didn't think that racism, whenever I didn't encounter it, or any form of discrimination, would determine my fate or my destiny. Because I think that in this country, race is no longer a determinant of destiny. You know, I think in this country we have gone beyond a certain scale of racism, where.
Well, you know, an earlier professor at Chicago there, Alan Bloom. Are you familiar with that name and the book he wrote, "The Closing of the American Mind"?
Of the American Mind. Oh, yeah, it's one of my favorite books.
Yeah, see, he predicted what has actually been happening and what has evolved from that time forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that we have seen where multiculturalism and identity politics and cultural relativism and these splintered groups in academia, whether it's, you know, with the women's studies or black studies or Chicano studies, each claiming that their discipline should take precedence over the traditional canon that has survived thousands of years. I mean, I teach courses on Plato, on Aristotle, on the Founding Fathers, on John Locke, you know, who influenced our American Constitution. These men and their works have survived hundreds, in some senses, millennia. And we have these people who are so mired in the shallow present that at the University of Manchester 2 days ago, they tore down Rudyard Kipling's beautiful poem, If. I don't know if you're familiar with that. You must be familiar with that. They tore it down on the ground that it was an oppressive, imperialistic poem. And I just thought, what kind of world are we living in where we're just going to erase our history, even with the tearing down of these monuments, you know, that these historic monuments that are offensive to many people. When my students ask me about this, I say, look, you cannot erase history. These landmarks, these monuments are part of American history.
Right.
And you just, they have value and meaning to certain people, and whether or not you like them, they're part of our history, and they're part of our collective history, and in order for us to move forward as a society, you cannot erase history. It's not a good approach to dealing with your fellow human being with whom you might have a difference. You just can't ban or erase anything that offends you. You've got to enter into a conversation with people. And we're living in some very, very dangerous times where people think that a disagreement constitutes their right to resort to physical violence, which is what we're seeing on campuses with the shutdown of the free speech by these far left students, motivated, I think, by their professors. And in the book, my book, We Have Overcome, an Immigrant's Letter to the American People, I do really talk at length about, you know, the philosophical foundations for the anti-free speech movement.
You know, you go, the abolition of reason, I think you cover that, right?
Yes, the abolition of reason, of rational argumentation. But you see, I actually think that this is all, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb here. I think what we're seeing in this country, and it comes with talk about having open borders, which I have an article coming out next week, about open borders. I think this whole shutting down of free speech, I think this whole indoctrination of our students into left-wing ideology is really a move to advance this country towards a socialist state. I think
right.
We saw this woman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who won the primary in New York, and she said, I will not rest until there's re-education for all, free health care, not affordable health care, free health care for all, free this. I think we're seeing, you know, when I was growing up, socialism was a bad word in America. And now we have a movement, or we have certain movements, where it's becoming normalized to talk about a socialist America. And this is what is really aggrieving me as a professor in the classroom when I see
professors, especially
in the last 2 years, emboldened in their efforts to do so.
Well, you know, Antonio Gramsci, the Italian, well, he put forward the idea that to bring communism to the West, you have to attack the culture base. And that's what pretty well has happened, has it not?
That's exactly true. That's exactly true.
Yeah, go ahead, Charlotte. What do you got?
Oh, I was going to say, what about the Charlotte Iserbein and the Fabian Society?
Yeah.
The whole push. I mean, there's been decades of effort to undermine us.
Yes. I think you're right, Charlotte, and I think the difference is that we had conservatives who held the moral high ground and who were willing to stand up for American values, liberty, freedom, individualism, capitalism. What's really disappointing me is that even when I try to publish articles that are very pro-American, very pro-free enterprise, you know, I wasn't a religious person in my youth, but I've since now renewed my faith, and I'm trying to become a very establish my faith back with God and bring God back into my life. That when conservatives in the past would talk about faith and talk about the link between faith and Americanism, we had intellectual ammunition. What disappoints me is the extent to which these individuals are capitulating to the radical far left, to the attack.
Right.
They're almost afraid to stand up and say, America is a great country. I'll give an example. When I wrote to a conservative journal an article and I said, America is an exceptional country, he said, can you please take that out? This is not a left-wing journal. This is a conservative magazine. I won't name the magazine because I don't want to embarrass them publicly. But the magazine editor said, we may even put off some of our conservative readers if we claim American exceptionalism. I said, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
This the greatest country on earth? This an exceptional country?
Right.
We have to put up walls and barriers to keep people out, where other countries have to put up walls to keep their people in from escaping.
Right.
And this is coming from conservatives who are so apologetic. And I think that until and unless we have a movement where we are proud of this country and we talk about the greatness of this country and the continued greatness of this country and why it's great. And in my book, We Have Overcome, I have one whole chapter that's called The Moral Meaning of America.
Okay.
You know, it's very accessible, but I go into great detail and explain to readers what makes this country the greatest country on earth. You know, why is it that it's an exceptionally great country? But Charlotte, I think you're right. I think that the attacks are not properly being met with a moral response. What we do is we engage in piecemeal, nitpicky fights with our adversaries, but we don't put up a philosophical, moral defense and say, we are proud of who we are great, we're the benefactor of most of the world's nations, we're the only country that I know of that wholesale will give humanitarian aid and relieve other countries of their debt. We're on the verge of becoming a refugee and a migrant camp in this country if we're not careful. So there's a little bit of a cowardice on the part of conservatives that I think I would like to play some role in some small role in using my voice to say, come on, we've got to speak up. It's not, we can't just attack. We've got to be in a proactive state, not just a reactionary state.
Okay. You know, what I see that's happened also is that people, the intimidation factor is what you're talking about just a few moments ago. But people are so intimidated now into being quiet, into a silence, you know?
Yeah.
And they're not speaking up, and they're not standing on principles like they used to just a few years ago.
That's right. That's right. We've abandoned principles for the purpose of expedience, for short-term gains, you know. This is part of the problem of our society today, where to hold on to principles, I think you have to be willing to sometimes suffer short-term losses and see the big picture.
Right.
And to hold a long range vision in mind. Yes.
Yeah, that's very true. And what we've done is what I was thinking about too, the education system has been very, very part of creating this bad delusional state. What do you think?
Well, could you say a little bit more about what you mean by delusional state?
Well, I'm saying it sounds like to me, I'm working on some other ideas and myself as far as a book goes called Delusion. But I see that the American public has become deluded or under false ideas, been under influence of false ideas.
Well, I think that's right. And I think our greatest victims are our young people. I think a lot of people over the age of 45 just sort of tune out and feel sort of helpless and, you know, there's nothing they can do and their votes don't matter. But I think that I'm in the classroom with 18 to 21 year olds and I see where more and more of them are joining these socialist unions, socialist organizations. They have bought into a script that indoctrinates them into thinking capitalism is coterminous with oppression. When I tell my students that capitalism has raised the standard of living for an unprecedented number of people in the world, in this country, it has reduced poverty, it has increased quality of life, they say that's not true. And I must say that one of the delusions that we face is this notion of income disparity. One thing that people have bought into is that income disparity is inherently unfair. And I try to tell my students, when I go back to the founding fathers, is that America was built on the premise of political equality, not economic equality. People have different talents. People introduce different values in the world. I, as a college professor, am not going to be paid equally as a hedge fund manager, nor should I really, or a physician or a brain surgeon. And I think that a lot of terminologies are just being confused because no one wants to take the time to explain to the American people the distinctions that need to be made. Instead, young people are being just bludgeoned over by pundits and also by their college professors, and the delusion continues.
You know, when it comes to capitalism, the attack that I see that's being mounted by the left is against capitalism in too general a way, and never do I hear crony capitalism or monopolistic capitalism that could be a problem out there still. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that we need to make the distinction between the separation between state and economics and crony capitalism, where there's a collusion between the state and these corporations. And I think people are rightfully upset when their taxpaying dollars are being used to bail out corporations or CEOs with no sense of accountability, no sense of restructuring their companies, are reaping the gains of expropriated funds from taxpayers. I think that's a legitimate cause, and I think a distinction has to be made between true capitalism, where there is no interference, there is no patronage on the part of the government, versus subsidies and versus patents and versus the creation of monopolies, which are created when government prohibits a competitor from entering a field. The lobbyists really are some of the problems here. And I think I really do think that I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that distinction really has to be made, where people see cronyism and they equate that with real capitalism.
Right, I think those are some good points. One other thing I've always thought over the years is that, You know, there's a lot, our leadership sometimes does things in our name that really shouldn't, they shouldn't have done, and maybe create some kind of a ugly American type of opinion by some of, you know, some of our foreign, you know, countries, you know, or, so, I mean, they do things in their, in the name of our country, and sometimes they do some things that they shouldn't do. What do you think? Our leadership.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I look to mind. We're not an NGO, and we unfortunately have to make alliances with some unsavory nation states in the world, who is like the pact that we have to make. It's silent and defeat Hitler.
Yeah, your phone is
you choose.
Okay, you might have to speak up a little bit more, Doctor.
Okay, it's sometimes I think that we have to sometimes make, we're not an NGO, and sometimes we have to make unfavorable alliances with nation states that are not the best nation states, like the pact we made with Stalin to defeat Hitler. You know, we told him after what we thought would be evil. But I think in the last 50 years, America really has lacked other principles of foreign policy. And, you know, we are in cahoots with Saudi Arabia, which is one of the largest, along with Iran and Qatar, sponsors of state terrorism. Saudi Arabia's Wahhabism and its other ideological underpinnings are form the philosophical basis for some of these terrorist groups. We forget that 19 of the hijackers of 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia. We're in alliance with Saudi Arabia, and yet we demonize other countries that have as poor human rights record as Saudi Arabia. So I would really like us to see us standing for American values, which is truth, which is liberty, democracy, republicanism, democracy, freedom, and hold some of these states accountable to certain standards. I think, you know, Reagan tried to do some of that when he was in power. But I think our foreign policy basically is just very, very messy and quite unprincipled, very, very unprincipled.
So where do we go from here, you know? What can we do to right this capsized boat, so to speak? What are some of the things that you were suggesting the other day on your interview on Fox, that maybe the people that endow the colleges and universities ought to put some strings on some of their contributions? What do you think?
Well, Bab, can you hear me clearly now? Can you hear me a little bit better?
Yeah, that's better now, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that battles have to be fought on many, many fronts. I think on the educational front, I think the richest gap in this country is not between the rich and the poor. It's between the intellectuals and the people. So I think one is the intellectuals in the universities are the disseminators of really bad ideas, evil, pernicious ideas, anti-American ideas, and we've got to defund them. We've got to tell the federal government, stop giving money, and we've got to tell alumni donors, stop giving money to universities that are spewing invectives against this great country. They're spewing anti-capitalism, anti-Americanism, denigrating this country. And we will see how fast these universities will restructure their humanities and their social science departments. And I want to see an America that assumes a principal leadership role in the world, where America is the leader of the free country.
Okay.
You know, as it was under the jurisdiction of Ronald Reagan, whom, if I could have voted at that time, I probably would have voted for him, but I was not a citizen, so I could not have voted then. A principled conservatism that advances the cause of liberty and freedom and that we don't have this kind of freewheeling, unprincipled, chaotic Americanism, not Americanism, the freewheeling advancement of alliances that we make with certain countries with no clear agenda of what is going on. See, one of the things that upset me about President Obama, and I was very hopeful when he was president, you know, I was for him and thought that this was going to be an amazing moment in American history.
Right.
Was when he started backpedaling and started talking about soft power, and he made that horrendous Iranian deal with the Iran deal.
Right.
You know, allowing Iran to build up this uranium arsenal.
Right.
Giving billions of dollars to one of the most nefarious countries in the world, the leading sponsor of state terrorism. I think America really... I'm writing a book that's going to come out next year on American foreign policy.
Okay.
America Dumb, The Case for an Imperialist America. And it's really, really going to ask the question, what is America's role in the 21st century? Either we pick up the mantle and say, we are the leader of the free world, because if we don't do it, China is going to take up the mantle, Russia is going to take up the mantle, and nuclearized Iran will take up the mantle. You know, if America has got to sort of look at the way in which China, for example, is economically annexing Africa, South America, slowly, you know, and we've got to question, what is our role in the 21st century? America used to have a leadership role, and I think we're slowly losing that. And it's going to take a set of very principled, in my mind, conservative leaders, because I think the far left is out to destroy America. So it's not going to come from them. I think it will come from a handful of very principled conservative leaders that are very inspired by what John McCain had to say about some of how America could go about reestablishing its credibility in the world, and not by being an apologist, but by assuming the traditional leadership role that it once had in this, you know, that we once exercised in this country.
Right. So, well, those are some good ideas, Charlotte. What would your thought be to try to right the capsized boat and to help America come back? What are your thoughts, Charlotte?
Well, I think our guest is a fantastic spokesman for America.
I think so, too. That's why I invited him on the air, and thank goodness he accepted.
Yes. I don't have any... I'm just observing and listening right now. I feel like everybody's trying to get their bearings. We've got a war that needs to stop in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It seems like we have leadership that doesn't have the proper agenda, you know.
Yeah, if I had anything to be critical of, Trump sometimes is pretty weak on some of his foreign affairs. What do you think, Dr. Hill?
I think that President Trump really is what I would call an improvisational leader. You know, he's a businessman, and people
right.
in business very often go on their gut reactions. They go on instinct.
Right.
They improvise and they make deals in the moment. And I don't think that you can lead a nation on those sorts of criteria. I think I would like to see the president really sit down each morning and listen to intelligent briefings, and to really understand the nature of that despot in North Korea, that he is a thug.
Right.
That he's not a nice person. And for the president to have a very, very clear understanding of how to deal strategically long-term with North Korea. I want the president to understand that we're dealing with Putin, who was a former KGB Kremlin underdog. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan would be rolling in his grave if he saw the relationship that we are having with Russia right now, this despot who meddled in our election, that needs to be really put in his place. And so my sense is that the president is not a bad person.
Right.
I think the president needs to have a more presidential approach in leading this country. I mean, I think he's adopted the business model, which on the domestic level seems to be working. African American unemployment has been the lowest it's been in
40 years. Exactly.
Right? Our economy is doing well. Unemployment is below what? No, I keep on losing track. It's like under 5%. So on the domestic level, I think some amazing things are happening. And Hispanic unemployment, by the way, is at an unprecedented low. But I would, you know, I don't think, and I do think that the president is right, for example, in asking NATO members to contribute more to their defense spending. It's just not right that these European countries should be spending more money on welfareism, doling out money to refugees who are unemployable and to Islamicists who are out to destroy Europe and destroy Western civilization, when they could be spending some of that money on defense. It's just not fair that America should be putting the majority of NATO's bill.
Right. I mean, it's like the crusades, the Muslim crusades into Europe, you know? See what I mean?
It's absolutely crazy. At the same time, I don't think that the president, as a president in this presidential mode, should be talking about the dismantling of NATO. I think you can have tough talk and say to these European leaders, look, step up to the plate, contribute more money, but then at the same time, talking about breaking up NATO has a very destabilizing effect among some of our strongest allies. And we do need these allies because, you know, God forbid should another terrorist attack occur on American soil, we are going to need to rely on the intelligence, the collective intelligence of a lot of these countries. And if we alienate them, if we alienate Germany, if we alienate France, it's to our own detriment. So I like the tough talk. I like the fact that I like the swagger. I like the fact that we have an administration that for the first time was talking about the way in which Islamicism and Islamicization of Europe is about to wipe out an entire continent of Western civilization. Nobody wants to talk about that.
Right.
And I think that's an amazing, you know, thing where we're slowly seeing in certain states where certain Muslims want to apply Sharia law in this country, and the president has said under my watch that it's never going to happen. I think my biggest concern with our current president is more on the international level. You know, I don't want to see America alienated from some of its traditional allies, that Ronald Reagan, for example, and spent an enormous amount of his political capital building those alliances. And we saw great things happening, like the fall of the Berlin Wall. That was a bloodless revolution. So I can't predict the future. I don't know what will happen. But that's my two cents on the foreign policy of where we are.
Well, so, you know, I agree with you. He's more of a businessman, so he's trying. He initially started to manage the country from a corporate viewpoint, but he needs to be more of a statesman than he has been. See, He's not a statesman yet. He's possibly headed that way, but he's not there yet.
Not there yet.
Yeah.
He's not there yet. Yeah.
And he has to hit back at people. Say, I got to get you back. That's not good. Say.
No, it's not good. Because bullying or vindictiveness,
right,
indicates weakness. You know, we have to always come from a position of strength, which we come from just always advancing our values or Americanism or ideals and principles that have worked for the past 248 years. And that's our greatest weapon. You know, America works, and it works for a reason. It doesn't work because we're a bullying country. It doesn't work because we're a vindictive country. It works because we have been a magnet country, a country that is intrinsically fair-minded and just and has stood for certain core principles that people aspire to.
Right.
They want to embody these principles, both in their character and in their political, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. They're just certain core American principles that people want to embody and to aspire to. And
I think deep down, I think President Trump has a love for this country. But this ego thing overrides many of his good things sometimes, you know? Ego interferes with his good things sometimes that he's trying to say or do.
Probably. No, I don't think anybody could doubt his patriotism and his love for America. It's very strong, and it's evident. I think some of us just sometimes have disagreement on the method by which that great love displays itself on the world stage. And
we've got about 2 minutes left in our program, Dr. Hill. What could be some of your concluding remarks you'd like to make, and advice to the American public or whatever you want to say? You've got 2 minutes. Okay.
I would just say to the American people, never ever give up on the fact that you can make a change in your country, that everyone carries within him or herself an enormous amount of power. That your agency, that your voice, you'd be surprised when you speak out, whether it's on social media, whether it's to your friends. Never stop believing, and never in the greatness of this country. Never become an apologist. Ever become an apologist for American greatness. And keep on fighting for what is good about this country. This is what I've tried to do in my book, Against Great Odds. A lot of publishers didn't want to publish it because they thought it was, too gung-ho America. And but we've got to band together in spite of our political differences. Whether we're on the left, we're on the right, we're all Americans, and we should want what is best for this country.
Right.
And we should celebrate the greatness of this country. What I would want to say to your listeners is never give up the pride that you feel in this country. Because it's a pride that you've earned. You've made this country what it is. Whether you're a police officer, whether you are a janitor sweeping a hallway at the moment, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a nurse's assistant cleaning someone's bed sore, you've made this country through your productive hard work. You've made this country what it is. And take pride in that. And never apologize to anyone for America. And don't ever accept the fact that America is a mean-spirited, unjust country. It is a benevolent country. And always promote that idea to whomever you come across. The victory and the battle will be won when we stop apologizing for who we are and assert with pride, intransigence, and rectitude that we are a just, fair-minded country in this world.
Well, I want to thank you tonight, Dr. Jason Hill, for your fine interview and some of the fine thoughts that you've expressed. And Charlotte, did you have any closing comments for just a second?
Oh, I just want to thank our guests. Yes, thank you, Dr. Hill. That was a well spent hour for me, and I just think you're a very eloquent speaker, and I loved what you had to say. So thank you for joining us.
All I can say is Dr. Jason Hill, the true American. Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Hill, you're an example.
By the book.
You're a very good example and a good model for anyone, and I don't care what color or ethnic group they are, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. Okay, good night.
Okay, goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, George.
Bye-bye. We want to thank Dr. Hill again and Charlotte Littlefield Brown for being with us, and just some end comments here. With Dr. Hill had one of the finest views that I've ever seen. And today, because of that view, it's a conservative view. He's a black man from Jamaica originally. And so his view today is in the minority at the major universities. And this is one of the reasons why I was able to provide him some spare time so he could express more, a greater degree of his real view. And I think he did that this evening. And we just want to thank everyone out there from the listening audience. We have up there right now on our site his click-offs at thesecrettruth.com where you can purchase his books. We have his biography up there and so forth. And he's just a fine writer, and he expresses some very fine ideas. And like I said at the end, it didn't matter what the ethnic or what you look like. This guy speaks to all Americans. And in essence, he has become an American. He was a legal immigrant to this United States, along with his mother and his brother and his grandmother. And they came in, and he did the right thing and became a naturalized citizen. And so this is what it's about, to do it in a very, very legal way. He did the right things. He conformed to the law. He became an outstanding success in his academic career there at DePaul. So he did a lot of good things for his family and then for his students. He said that he tried to convey to them a very, very meaningful, way of looking at America, but a very positive one. I want to thank you again, Dr. Hill. Thank you.